From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Constituents deserve better, and they deserve a Republican, not a liberal Democrat, representing them.
Tom DeLay resigns. By stepping down, the Texas congressman can spend his campaign war chest not on re-election, but on his legal defense. Then, military tribunals resume at Guantanamo.
The military commissions that are resuming at Guantanamo this week are an embarrassment to the United States. They are inconsistent with any recognized system of law, whether from the Constitution or international law. And the fact that they have to bring forward a kid who was 15 when he was captured in Afghanistan shows just how much the Guantanamo detainees are the worst of the worst.
And we'll speak with the attorney from the ACLU, then leading Arab journalist Zaki Shahab on Inside the Resistance, the Iraqi insurgency, and the future of the Middle East.
It's important to differentiate between local insurgency and international terrorist organization represented by Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And I feel that it's easy and possible to have some kind of dialogue with the local insurgency, because this would be a step to stabilize the area where they are functioning, and on later stage to have some kind of political dialogue takes place. And third is to kick Al-Qaeda leader and his band of terrorists, foreign terrorists, out of the country.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Massachusetts lawmakers have passed a bill that would require its citizens to be provided with some form of health insurance. The bill would force people to buy their own health insurance and provide subsidies for a private health plan for those who can't afford the coverage on their own. Companies that don't provide health insurance will also be forced to pay $300 per employee penalty. While the bill drew widespread praise, some analysts question whether the state has committed adequate funding. According to a recent study, Massachusetts would have to spend four times the amount provided in the bill to bring health coverage to its uninsured residents. Alan Sager, a professor of health services at Boston University, told The Wall Street Journal the bill would force people to purchase insufficient coverage beyond their financial reach. Sager said, quote, "This is more money for business-as-usual health care. Lawmakers conceived an elephant 18 months ago, but have given birth to a mouse." In Iraq, Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri is resisting a U.S.-backed effort to bring about his resignation. In an interview with The Guardian newspaper of London, al-Jafri said he'd been elected democratically and would not step down. Last week, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, notified Shiite politicians President Bush no longer supports al-Jafri and wants a new leader. Meanwhile, a key Iraqi leader is backing the U.S. stance. In an interview with the BBC, Vice President Adil Abdul Mahdi said he has urged al-Jafri to give up his position because he's lost the confidence of Iraq's Sunnis and Kurds. Abdul Mahdi is the most senior Shiite government official to call on al-Jafri to resign. At least 22 people were killed in violence around Iraq on Tuesday. The deadliest incident came in Baghdad, when 10 people were killed in a car bombing. In other Iraq news, Saddam Hussein was cross-examined today for the first time since his trial began 6 months ago. Hussein said he'd approved death sentences for Shiite opponents during the 1980s because he believed they were involved in a plot to assassinate him. Prosecutors replied by asking Hussein whether he knew many of his victims were children under 18. The session came one day after Saddam Hussein was given new charges of genocide and crimes against humanity in the 80s crackdown against the Kurds. In Ireland, a former Sinn Féin member who spied for the British government has been murdered. The man, Dennis Donaldson, admitted last year he spied on fellow Irish nationalists. Donaldson's murder comes as the Irish and British governments are attempting to relaunch stalled peace negotiations. Both the Sinn Féin and the Irish Republican Army deny involvement in the killing. This is Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams.
I want to condemn without reservations this very brutal killing. I want to extend condolences to the Donaldson family. I want to dissociate Sinn Féin and all of those scores of thousands of, hundreds of thousands of Irish Republicans who support the peace process from this killing.
That was Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. In France, up to 3 million people turned out Tuesday for continued protests against a new job law that makes it easier for employers to fire young workers. In Paris, a peaceful rally attended by hundreds of thousands of students ended in violence when a small group of protesters clashed with police. In the occupied territories, one Palestinian was killed and seven were wounded when Israeli tanks shelled areas in the northern Gaza Strip. The wounded included a mother and her six-month-old baby. Meanwhile, two people were wounded when Israeli aircraft fired missiles at an abandoned building in the compound of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. In Nepal, the royal government has issued a new decree banning all public gatherings in the capital of Kathmandu. The ban comes ahead of a mass pro-democracy protest organized for Saturday. Nepal's seven leading opposition parties have also called a nationwide general strike set to begin on Thursday. In Sudan, the UN's top humanitarian official has abandoned his effort to visit the Darfur region. Jan Eglin, the UN's Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, says the Sudanese government is trying to hide the ethnic cleansing that's occurring in the area. He spoke about his efforts on Tuesday.
Suddenly not being welcome in South Darfur, nor in West Darfur, nor in Khartoum, where they say come back in some weeks, is, I think, a sign that they don't want me to see how bad it has become in southern Darfur, where tens of thousands have had to flee from renewed attack against vulnerable populations in villages. For example, around the place I was planning to go, Jereida in southern Darfur.
That was UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs Jan Eglin. In Thailand, Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra has stepped down. His resignation comes after months of growing protests against his rule. He'll be replaced by his deputy prime minister, a longtime close associate. In Colombia, the UN is warning battles between government forces and rebel groups are threatening the existence of some of the world's oldest and smallest indigenous groups. More than 1,700 people from the Wunan indigenous group have fled their homes in the last week following the murders of two of their leaders. Meanwhile, close to 80 members of the Nukak group were recently expelled from their ancestral lands. Back in the United States, the deputy press secretary for the Department of Homeland Security was arrested in Maryland Tuesday for trying to solicit sexual relations with a child over the internet. Brian Doyle was arrested after he made contact online with an undercover police officer posing as a 14-year-old girl. Doyle has been charged with using his computer to seduce a child and transmitting harmful materials to a minor. According to the police, Doyle identified himself online as the DHS deputy press secretary and gave his office phone number. On Capitol Hill, House Republicans have drafted legislation supporting Capitol Police in response to a confrontation last week between an officer and Democratic Congressmember Cynthia McKinney. The incident occurred when McKinney went around a metal detector, as lawmakers are permitted to do, while not wearing her congressional lapel pin. McKinney has complained she was the victim of racial profiling. In Ohio, Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell has disclosed he purchased stock from the electronic voting machine company Diebold. Blackwell is Ohio's top election official. Both Blackwell and Diebold became synonymous with the controversy surrounding Ohio's voting irregularities during the 2004 presidential elections. Blackwell says the stock purchase was made by a financial manager without his consent and that he's divested the stock. Last year, the state of Ohio reached a multi-million dollar deal that would see it pay Diebold $2,700 per voting machine. And in Wisconsin, 18 communities approved a ballot measure Tuesday that call on the U.S. to immediately withdraw all troops from Iraq. Six communities voted down the measure. The issue was put on the ballot following a grassroots campaign organized by anti-war groups. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the downfall of Tom DeLay, once the most powerful Republican lawmaker on Capitol Hill.
I am announcing my intention to resign my seat in the House.
On Tuesday, the former House Majority Leader formally announced he'll resign and not seek re-election in November. The move comes just days after DeLay's former top aide and personal friend, Tony Rudy, pleaded guilty to conspiring with Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff and accepting bribes while working for DeLay. a second aide. Michael Scanlon pleaded guilty in November in federal corruption investigations. Both Rudy and Scanlon are said to be cooperating with federal investigators, as is Abramoff, who pled guilty in January to bribing public officials and defrauding Native American tribes out of tens of millions of dollars. On Tuesday, DeLay denied the corruption scandals played a role in his decision to resign, saying, quote, "The Abramoff affair has nothing to do with me." When DeLay was asked if he had done anything immoral in office, he responded by saying, quote, "We are all sinners." DeLay was forced to step down as House Majority Leader last year after he was indicted in Texas on charges he broke campaign finance laws by illegally funneling corporate donations to state candidates. On Tuesday, DeLay admitted his chances of winning re-election were only 50-50.
This seat is precious. It's precious to the Republican majority, and it's precious to my constituents. My constituents deserve better, and they deserve a Republican, not a liberal Democrat, representing them.
One former aide, John Feary, said DeLay kept campaigning for his reelection up until now just to amass more campaign contributions that could be used to pay off future legal fees. DeLay reportedly has about $1.2 million in unspent campaign contributions. To talk about Tom DeLay's legacy, we're joined now from Texas by Lou DeBose. He's author of the book The Hammer Comes Down, The Nasty, Brutish, and Shortened Political Life of Tom DeLay. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lou DeBose.
Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about this latest news? Tom DeLay not only announcing he will not seek re-election, but that he's resigning. And when do you understand that will be?
Amy, I can't. I'm getting this sort of weird repetition, and the sound is coming back again and again and again.
Can you hear me now?
I can. Yes, but yes.
It's better. Can you talk about when you understand Tom DeLay will resign and the significance of what has happened?
The sound is all scrambled. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Could you dial through again?
Yes, we will. Okay. We'll go back to Lou DeBose in a moment.
عذبني كتير بس فرقنا أكتر واستأجل وقت إنه هالوضع يتغير فعشان هيك
خلينا نفتح صفحة جديدة كل يوم عن جديد صفحة بيضة من دوم خط وشحابي ليش ما نسوي تغيير لوضع العرب الخطير عشان حكومة صهيونية كل يوم في تفجير كل يوم في فدائية في عملية انتحارية من هيك انسى إنه تكون في حرية أهمية للنفس العربي كل صفوا ضدنا 100% فأكيد في عنصرية شتم قتل وكراهية كله راح ورا بيع الإنسانية الحرية الكرامي والأخوية ولا ولا حدا عاد في أهمية كله بيشرح كله بخون مع إنه أنا صدقني مش ضد اليهود هن ضد وطني وشعبي ضد أهلي وجدادي ما حبتي لمين لأولادي
ولا مرة تتأكيد يا ما نسأل ليش ولا مرة تتأكيد يا ما نسأل ليش
ليش نعدل ليش نفجر ليش انتحر ليش نقبر
ولا مرة تسأل كيف دائما نسأل ليش ليش
لأنه أصعب من وضع العرب هم فيش
فهمني ليه قاعد بزير الكل عم بموت هذا إشي خطير الكل بإيده سلاح ما حدا عم برتاح الكل
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll try to fix the phone line, but for now we're moving to our next segment as we turn to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, where a Canadian teenager and nine other detainees are appearing before a military tribunal this week, even though the legality of the pretrial hearings remains in doubt. Last week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case Hamdan versus Rumsfeld that'll decide whether the government can legally use military commissions to try detainees. Although the Supreme Court has not yet ruled on the case, the military is going ahead with the pretrial hearings. One of the detainees appearing before the tribunal today is the Canadian-born Omar Khadr. U.S. forces detained him 4 years ago in Afghanistan. He was 15. Human rights lawyers say Omar is the first person in modern world history to face a military commission for alleged crimes committed as a child. He's accused of killing U.S. Special Forces soldier Christopher Speer with a grenade during a firefight near the village of Khost, Afghanistan, in July 2002. Earlier this week, Khadr's attorney challenged the fairness of the proceedings. Over the past few months, the attorney, U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Colby Vokey, has only been allowed to talk to his client for 2 hours, and he's been unable to see all the evidence against the teen. Khadr's legal team is expected to file a motion to halt the tribunal proceedings, arguing the hearing's presiding officer does not have the power to put the Canadian on trial. Similar complaints have been expressed by other attorneys representing detainees before the military tribunal. To discuss the military tribunals at Guantanamo, we're joined in our firehouse studio by Ben Wisner, staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. In January, he traveled to Guantanamo Bay to observe some of the proceedings before the military tribunals. He's also been closely monitoring the Supreme Court case Hamdan versus Rumsfeld and authored a friend of the court brief in the case. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me on the program, Amy.
Why don't we start with the teenager? Tell us about his case.
Well, Omar Khadr, as you said in the lead-in, was 15 years old when he was detained in Afghanistan after a firefight. And what's striking about this case is that only 10 of the 500-some men and boys who are held at Guantanamo have been designated for these war trials. You would think that the United States would put before the world the worst of the worst to counter the very accurate information that hundreds of people there have been swept up in a dragnet. And for the United States to put a teenager before the world as one of the worst and the worst shows really just what a mess the entire Guantanamo system has become.
Well, tell us about his case in particular. Where was he picked up in Afghanistan, and how now the military is responding?
Well, there was a firefight in which evidently the military has witnesses that can testify that Omar Khadr threw a grenade during this firefight. What's interesting about this charge is that Khadr is charged with murder. When we go to Afghanistan, we are doing so as part of a war on terror. When people resist that war, they are unprivileged belligerents who are charged with crimes. And Khadr's charge is one of the more serious of the people who have been brought before the tribunal so far. Most of the detainees who have been charged with crimes have been charged with the non-existent war crime of conspiracy.
Now, talk about him being brought up, Khadr being brought up in this military tribunal at the time the Supreme Court is weighing the Hamdan case. And explain, if you will, the Hamdan case in particular, who Hamdan was and why this is significant.
Hamdan is alleged to be Osama bin Laden's driver. And Hamdan is among these first 10 detainees who has been designated for war trials. Hamdan's military defense lawyer, Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift, was confronted with this bewildering system that the United States is making up as it goes along, and took his training seriously and said, this is not fair, this is unconstitutional, this violates international law. He sought out Georgetown Law professor Neil Katyal and said, we have to put a stop to these military tribunals. They brought a lawsuit saying that the tribunals were illegitimate, that they were not authorized by Congress, that they violated the Geneva Conventions, that they were unconstitutional, and they were able to persuade a lower court to agree and to halt the tribunals. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, with John Roberts, our new Chief Justice, sitting on the panel, reversed and allowed the commissions to proceed, and that case made its way last week to the United States Supreme Court. We and others have said that it's absolutely inappropriate for the United States to continue putting these people on trial while the Supreme Court has expressed serious doubts about whether the tribunals are even legitimate.
Now, John Roberts ruled on behalf of the Bush administration before he became Chief Justice. In fact, when he was being considered to be nominated to the Supreme Court and had been meeting at the White House a number of times. And then Antonin Scalia spoke about this case before he heard it.
Well, there was one empty chair during the argument because the Chief Justice was appropriately recused. I think a lot of people were hoping there would be two empty chairs during that argument. And in fact, five retired generals and admirals on the day of the argument presented a motion to the court saying that Scalia ought to recuse himself because he appeared to have prejudged that case. Not only did Scalia not recuse himself, but it was quite clear from the oral argument where Scalia's sympathies lie in this case.
Talk about the oral arguments. Were you surprised by how the Supreme Court justices questioned the attorneys?
Well, I have to say, in a way, yes. And I think what it shows is that the court does not take lightly attempts to strip the court of its traditional authority. And so you had at least five justices who are expressing serious doubts about what's going on with these tribunals and about whether Congress has the authority to tell the courts to butt out. The most important vote in this case, as in every case from now on, will be the vote of Justice Kennedy, who seems to be paying more attention to international law and our treaty obligations. And Justice Kennedy was very bothered by the government's argument that the Supreme Court should stay out of this dispute until after all the tribunals have been completed.
Former Attorney General John Ashcroft recently gave a speech to students where he said, this is ridiculous. These people are do not deserve the standard judicial treatment to be brought into a court, have their day in court, as prisoners of war weren't in the past given that right. What is your response?
Well, I want to say a couple of things in response. The harshest criticism of the military tribunals has come not from human rights organizations and civil libertarians like me. It's come from former members of the prosecution team whose internal emails that were leaked to the press described the commission system as fixed, as a fraud on the American people, with commission members... prosecution members, with the commission members handpicked to ensure conviction. These comments are described in our friend of the court brief before the Supreme Court. These were internal criticisms.
These were the prosecutors of those at Guantanamo.
They were former members of the prosecution team, would be a better way of describing them. They are no longer prosecutors. They have found people who are more willing to toe the line. This system is being invented from whole cloth. We have a constitutional tradition that is several hundred years old. We have a military justice system that's half a century old. We have international treaty obligations that set minimum standards for a fair trial. All of those have been thrown out for these commissions, where you have members who are handpicked by the administration, where you have President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld as the final arbiters of guilt and innocence, where you have evidence that may be extracted through coercion and torture that might be used to convict the detainees. This system is a mess, as I said. And it's amazing for me to say that, but this system, as bad as it is not the worst thing going on at Guantanamo. In some ways, it's the best thing that's going on at Guantanamo, because the 495 other men and boys have been charged with absolutely nothing.
We're talking to Ben Wisner, staff attorney for the ACLU, who observed the tribunals held in January, including some of the proceedings in the Hamdan case. What was it like when you went down?
Well, I wasn't expecting much. These were billed as simple arraignments where charges would be read and so-called voir dire would be done of the judge. But what was inspiring about being there was seeing just how committed the uniformed military defense lawyers are to their clients. These are people who are members of the U.S. Armed Forces, who have been trained, but who took law school seriously, who took their constitutional oaths seriously, and who consistently say that the system is fixed, that it's unfair, and that it's unjust. And to see them sparring with the handpicked judges in these cases and contesting every inch of the way shows that even in a flawed system, having a lawyer, having a counsel, having someone stand up and defend you does make a difference in the proceeding.
Ben Wisner, you also at the ACLU have been looking at the issue of domestic spying. Can you talk about the significance of this, being the staff attorney on these issues? You've seen the documents that where it shows the FBI was spying on, for example, the Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh, the Peace Center.
You know, to me, the real significance of these documents that describe under headings like anti-terrorism unit or international terrorism matters, things like anti-war protests in Pittsburgh, is that it shows just how much the administration is asking when it says, trust us. The NSA is an anti-terrorist surveillance program. Well, what definition of terrorism is the United States using when it says that the NSA is intercepting only terrorist communications? If it's using the definition that you find scattered throughout these FBI records, then there may be a great number of people who have been deliberately selected for NSA surveillance. So it's another example of the abuse of power, of the concentration of power in the administration, and of unchecked authority.
Tell us about some of the names you have come across. Some are particularly targeted, and others you see the names of groups when looking at other groups.
Well, it won't be a surprise, I think, to some of your listeners that the FBI has had a long interest in groups like People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And the documents that we've posted on our website and that I hope your listeners will go and look at show really a long campaign on the FBI's part to try to tar PETA as just a front group for more militant and violent groups like the Animal Liberation Front. And yet they find no evidence of this consistently. And so although they maintain these domestic terrorism investigations, and are able to persuade the IRS to conduct audits of groups like PETA and Greenpeace, they never find the evidence that they're looking for that these groups are involved in violent activities.
When you were looking at the file on Greenpeace, you found other groups?
Well, there's one particularly amusing document. Maybe some of your listeners will find it frightening, but most of us had a chuckle, in which an FBI special agent describes the Catholic Worker Group as advocating a communist-like redistribution of resources and peace and love through prayer. And again, the idea that this is sitting there in an FBI record should be an embarrassment to the government.
What other groups are being watched?
Well, we have obtained records on a variety of anti-war groups, on United for Peace and Justice, which is the large umbrella anti-war organization in this country, on PETA, on Greenpeace. Food Not Bombs is a group that gives vegetarian food to the homeless and protests war and has turned up in a number of these files. And of course, some of the larger Arab and Muslim groups have been monitored by the FBI as well.
So you get these documents, you see, you alert the groups.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, we have been working with the groups in requesting the documents and in bringing litigation against the FBI to compel the release of these documents.
And once this happens, can you compel the FBI to stop? And what about the Pentagon, who also has their terror lists that include, for example, Quaker groups in Lake Grove, Florida?
Yeah. We know a lot less about the Pentagon. There was a document that was leaked to NBC News that showed a variety of anti-war protests and also anti-military recruitment protests that had been kept in a Pentagon database under the heading Threats to the Military. And some of them were deemed credible, some not. But they involved groups like the Quakers, as you said, groups that were protesting against the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. To its apparent credit, the Pentagon, unlike the FBI, seems to have acknowledged that it was absolutely improper for the Pentagon to be maintaining this information. We have filed a series of FOIA requests to try to get to the bottom of what happened and how broad the Pentagon's activities were, but we've received nothing in advance. The FBI, on the other hand, has really dug in its heels and has been unapologetic about what it's been doing and has been offering very unpersuasive defenses that all of these records are derived from individual criminal investigations. But that's simply contradicted by the records. And I would urge your listeners to go to our website at aclu.org/spy files and take a look through some of the documents that we've posted there.
Well, we will also, of course, link to the ACLU spy files at democracynow.org. Ben Wisner, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ben Wisner, staff attorney for the ACLU, went down to Guantanamo, also is the staff attorney at the ACLU on the issue of surveillance. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, where you can find our transcripts as well as our headlines in Spanish. We turn now to Iraq, where guerrilla violence killed at least 21 people Tuesday. In eastern Baghdad, a car bombing near a Shiite mosque left at least 10 people dead. Another blast in the capital killed a woman and her two young sons. Elsewhere in Baghdad, two employees of the United Arab Emirates embassy were slain as they left the building. Separate attacks across the country killed several more, including a judge and several Iraqi policemen. On Monday, 9 U.S. troops were killed, making it the deadliest day of the year for the United States. 13 U.S. troops have already died this month, nearly half the number who died in all of March. The latest bloodshed comes amidst reports that Jordanian militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has been forced to step down as the leader of a coalition of Iraqi militants. Huthaifa Azam, whose father was a mentor of Osama bin Laden, told an Arabic news channel that Zarqawi was replaced by an Iraqi 2 weeks ago. He claimed some were unhappy about Zarqawi's tactics and tendency to speak for the insurgency as a whole. Huthaifa Azam claims close contact with the insurgents and is the son of Azam Azam, who is described by the BBC as, quote, one of the seminal figures in the modern jihadi movement in the Muslim world. Today, we're going to take a look inside the Iraqi resistance with a leading Arab journalist. Zaki Shahab is one of the few reporters to have met the numerous groups and individuals that make up the armed resistance in Iraq. In fact, he was the first journalist to broadcast interviews with members of the Iraqi resistance. Born in a refugee camp in southern Lebanon, Zaki Shahab grew up during the country's civil war. When he was 17, Israeli forces launched a heavy assault on the camp. Shahab covered the story for a local paper and has worked as a journalist ever since. He's covered the Middle East for 25 years, has traveled through the war zones from Somalia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kosovo, and Bosnia. Zaki Shahab is currently political editor of the London-based Al Hayat newspaper and the Arabic TV channel LBC. He's author of the book Inside the Resistance, the Iraqi Insurgency, and the Future of the Middle East. We welcome you to Democracy Thanks, Now! Amy. It's Thank good you. To have you with us. Well, what about this latest news of Zarqawi?
Nothing confirmed. My information that Huthaifa Azam, the person who was quoted saying this, have denied saying such thing in details. As you know, Huthaifa Azam's father is Abdullah Azam, not Azam Azam. And Abdullah Azam was the mentor of the Islamic Shihadists who first went to Pakistan and then to Afghanistan to fight the Soviet invasion then. Abdullah, in general, was a moderate man. And many believe that he have distanced himself from day one from Osama bin Laden. At that time, Osama bin Laden, as you know, was supported by the West, by the United States, by Saudi Arabia, by most of the modern Arab governments, who at that time was happy to see the Soviets, step deep in trouble in Afghanistan. So Huthaifa is based at the moment in Jordan after he left Islamabad. And I suspect how far he is in touch with these extreme elements, because for them, he's a moderate man. So the news about Zarqawi being sidelined or being put aside or being replaced is not really, can't be confirmed by one source.
Can you tell us about who Zarqawi is?
Zarqawi, as you know, he's have approved by the bin Laden, by al-Qaeda. He's their emir in what's called, al-Qaeda terms, the emir of the country of two rivers.
The country of two rivers being Iraq?
Iraq, Bilad al-Rafidain, which have two banks. So that's a reference to Iraq because of the main two rivers which run all over the country. So I think there are so many changes in Iraq in terms of insurgency. And when you talk about what's going on in Iraq, we have to differentiate between local insurgency and international insurgency who is like, you know, coming to Iraq from different Arab countries and even maybe from Western countries as well. So that's why now a lot of things going on. There are some information which can't be confirmed about how far is the rift between the local insurgency and the international terrorist organization who are functioning in Iraq.
What would you say would be the percentage of foreign fighters and Iraqi fighters?
You know, Iraqi fighters making the main bulk of the insurgency. When we talk about foreign fighters in Iraq, they are just, we're talking about a few hundreds, not more than that. And the main bulk, the main activities are carried by local Iraqis. It's true that there are some sophisticated attacks taking place in Iraq against American-led coalition. But the fact that this kind of attacks always carried by local Iraqis, who either, you know, ex-military personnel or intelligence people who have exact knowledge of where to target from far distances. I don't believe that a militant who have joined al-Qaeda in Iraq from Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Lebanon at the age of 21 and just to go to Iraq in a few weeks, he would be capable of like shooting a plane or targeting an embassy or a headquarter for American forces or other allied forces with the United States. So this is really carried by local Iraqis who don't mind that the responsibility for the media carried by al-Zarqawi, because these kind of people, they are looking for a role in the political future of their country. And if they are face-to-face with the American-led coalition in Iraq, then they have no future or no role to play in the political process. That's why at some stage they don't mind being like, you know, carried these attacks and al-Zarqawi, you know, announced the responsibilities.
Some people have questioned whether al-Zarqawi even exists. Do you believe he does?
Yeah, he exists. You know, I was in Baghdad just for the last election, and I met the head of Iraqi intelligence, who himself have confirmed to me that, yes, al-Zarqawi was arrested a year and 2 months ago, and he was arrested in Fallujah. And he was released the next night because the local Iraqi police could not recognize his face. And he investigated the case. And to confirm this more than that, what he told me, he said a few weeks later, a suicide bomb attack took place in Baghdad next to the Jordanian embassy. And the suicide bomber was a Saudi who survived the attack. And he questioned my friend, who's General Hussein Kamal. He's the head of intelligence at the Ministry of Interior in Iraq till today. He said he questioned the survived terrorist.
The Saudi
guy.
Bomber.
And this Saudi guy, he told him that Zarqawi himself told him that he have survived a long-term arrest after being released in Fallujah because the local police not confirm his identity.
And this was soon after the siege of Fallujah in November of 2004.
Definitely. This happened in 2005.
Hmm. We're talking to Zaki Shahab. He's the political editor of Al Hayat newspaper based in London. He's author of Inside the Resistance. Can you talk about how you first made contact with the resistance, which actually goes back to you being a kid in the refugee camps in southern Lebanon with your pen pal?
Yeah, I grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon, and, as every refugees, we have, like, limited resources. So, you know, and we have, like, no luck in enjoying the civilized world in terms of playing and gardens and, you know, public stuff. And I think our way of entertainment, either playing football or looking for all the newspapers. And as my other pen pals was doing, I picked one of the, you know, addresses in one of the magazines, old magazines. And it happened that this guy I started corresponded with at the age of 8 is an Iraqi from Fallujah. And I've never been to Iraq before, you know, I picked the name. So 35 years later, you know, straight after the fall of the regime of Saddam Hussein, I went to cover the developments in Fallujah and the fighting and the confrontation. And after I finished my assignment, I decided to look for my pen pal. And the only thing I can remember of the old days is, like, his name and the secondary school I used to correspond with. So I went to a few mosques looking for him. And they told me he left, he's living in Baghdad, he's a doctor, he's well-educated, he's well-off, and so many things. And it took me a couple of days till I managed to trace him. And it happened that he was, as a doctor, having his surgery in al-Ramadi, the capital of the Sunni insurgency in Iraq. So anyway, I called him that day, we met, and we try to catch up on a different level.
And what did you find about his family, about his sons, and about him and the Iraqi insurgency?
In fact, he told me, you know, the day we met him the first time, he brought his young kids, or like, you know, graduated from medical schools in Iraq. One of them was a lawyer, other a doctor, other like a medical student, and other was 16 years old, is about to take his A-levels. But the sad thing, when I met him a year later, he told me that the three of his kids were arrested, or four of them were arrested. Two were in Ramadi, one was in Abu Ghraib, and the other was in the south. And the reason is, for their arrest, is like his neighbor have betrayed him for no reason. Just, you know, that's really one of the biggest mistakes. So many people, you know, they try to take it on American-led coalition, but it's just because if you don't like X, you just can say he is member of the insurgency or resistance. And the result is, it's not okay, people that knows that X have betrayed them. But the fact is, you know, the many mistakes committed by the way we handle the situation in Iraq have led to frustration and anger. And many have expressed this anger against the American-led coalition.
Were his sons in the insurgency? Was he?
No, you've got, I've just said, his son, one of them is a lawyer, one of them is a medical student, one of them is a practicing doctor, one of them was A-levels. But at some stage, he was like offered to be the governor of Ramadi, and he turned the offer down. So the one who replaced him or who have occupied that space have betrayed him that he's like a supporter or sympathetic to the insurgency. And then it ended up, you know.
What was the beginning of the insurgency? Would you bring it back to the siege of Fallujah?
Not really like this. You know, we have to be fair. I was one of many who felt that invading Iraq is wrong. But when I went to Iraq and I saw how Iraqis have welcomed the overthrow of the regime, I've changed my mind. I saw Iraqis in the Kurdish areas dancing after the fall of the regime. Majority of Shiites in the south have welcomed the fall of the regime. And Sunnis in general, it's true that they were like conservative in their feeling, but I visited Takrit, the hometown of Saddam Hussein, and I met the majority of leaders of the tribe. They were, all of them, they told me in a meeting they had in one of the farms, that they were really not happy with Saddam Hussein, and they suffered from his regime like any others in the south and in the north. But they couldn't do anything about it. So they gathered 6 weeks after the fall of Takrit to tell the world, we hated Saddam Hussein, and we have suffered on his hand as Sunnis like Shia and Kurd. So I changed. When I see the majority of Iraqis were happy to see Saddam Hussein, you know, I changed my mind. What happened later is the kind of mistakes. How we handled the situation, there was no plan how to handle the situation in Iraq. You know, I was surprised a few weeks ago when I read the memoirs of Paul Bremer, the American ambassador there.
The memoir of Paul Bremer.
Yeah, it was interesting to see him saying what he said. I was happy a few days ago to hear the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, saying for the first time we have committed thousands of mistakes. We should have handled this from day one, because handling the situation in Iraq in a proper way should have saved tens of thousands of Iraqi lives, and I'm sure thousands of American and other lives.
We're talking to Zaki Shahab. He's political editor, London-based Al Hayat newspaper and the Arabic TV channel LBC. He's written the book Inside the Resistance, The Iraqi Insurgency and the Future of the Middle East. We'll come back to continue speaking with him in a minute.
شهيد والألم من الصميم ما عاد فينا نتحمل عهالظلم يا عالم الصبر لربك التحكيم على أرواحهم لنقرأ بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم 13 شهيد أفر الدمع دليل على القبر لساته عم بيسيل أخذته الكثير دمع اللي سال على دمه اللي سال قال استخسرته فينا ليش حتى الأقل من القليل 13 شهيد ايه ما صعب الفراق مو العين ما بتكفي بكى وأنين ما بفيد 13 شهيد ايه ما أقوى الاشتياق وجع بزيد كيف قطعتوا الدم عن الوريد موطني 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 الشباب لن يكل همه أن تستقل أو يبيد نستقي من الردى ولن نكون للعداء كالعبيد
العبيد.
جينا لنحكي القصة ودمعي بعيني لسه. قالوا لي ايش يا خاين الخاين اللي بينسى كيف صار وقلبك يقصى تمشي وتنسى القصة تنسى الماضي اللي كاين والخوف بقلبك يرسى كيف ننسى دم اللي راح ما راح خليته طالع من بيته وعالراي وطالع.
Palestinian rap group called DAM. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guest is Zaki Shahab, political editor, London-based Al Hayat newspaper. Arabic TV channel LBC spent a good deal of time over the last few years in Iraq, has written the book Inside the Resistance, The Iraqi Insurgency and the Future of the Middle East, and is writing a new book on Hamas. But back to Iraq, how you get around. One of the things you talk about is, and this now in light of the release of Joe Carroll, the freelance journalist who is writing for the Christian Science Monitor, how many Iraqis are kidnapped every day and Arab journalists that we don't know about, that whose names we don't know?
It's really sad because we all we hear about is the kidnapping of a foreign journalist or a Western citizen in Iraq. But we never heard about the hundreds of Iraqis who are kidnapped every week. At least 16 Iraqi journalists were killed last year. 16. And many till today have disappeared, and nobody tracing them. Even hardly anyone knows their names. Some of them, they work for television station. Some of them, they work like for newspapers, local television station, and others. And believe me, large numbers of journalists who just left the jobs because they've been threatened. And they didn't dare even to tell that we have been threatened because they worried about their life and their families. So they just left the jobs peacefully and stayed at home because they've been threatened. We talk about Iraqis. Only since the fall of the regime, more than 300 Iraqi university lecturers have been killed. 300. If you visit the capital of Jordan.
These are professors and lecturers.
Lecturers at Iraqi universities. If you visit Baghdad, the capital, you'll find, you know, most of the intellectual Iraqis, most of the professional ones, lawyers, doctors, businessmen, have left the country because they can't afford to live the life they are, you know, they are facing now in Iraq. Everyone who can afford to leave the country is leaving it because if themselves they are not threatened as professionals, their kids are threatened. And so many kidnappings for small kids going to school just because these gangs want money from their families. And you just, this is something happens every day. What we can talk about security Iraq, if the sister and the brother of the Minister of Interior in Iraq today being kidnapped, what about the local Iraqis, the poor Iraqi who have no bodyguards to go around with him when he wants to go to his work or to carry on with his daily life? Iraq is extremely in a difficult situation. All the main roads between the capital and every single major city in Iraq is not safe.
How do you get around? How do you get around as a journalist?
You know, believe me, I used to go and I used to tell my friends, you know, that I'm going to Iraq. But the last two, three trips I made to Iraq, I preferred not to tell anyone because everyone will say you are crazy to go there. I know what kind of risks. I've traveled with many others. And one of them, after we crossed from the capital to the airport, it's just 20 minutes drive. He told me, Zaki, all the way, the only one thing I was thinking about is how I was going to be kidnapped and the way I was going to die. That's really the kind of thoughts you have. But because of the job, you feel you have to go somewhere. You have to take the risks. You know, it's mad. I, myself, if I see a foreign journalist, you know, kidnapped in Iraq, I'll say he's mad because it's really mad to go there. No one can secure a life. If you are with American forces, you can be targeted by the insurgents. If you are on your own, you can be targeted by the gangs. Yes, so it's very difficult, and no one can secure a life. It's just, you know, it's danger. But we have to take the risk. And always, it's, you know, we have local correspondents there. But sometimes when you live in the situation for so long, it became difficult for you to try to differentiate, to know what's exactly, what kind of development takes place. That's why we have to take the risk. The one thing which is really of great importance as well, because of the divisions in the country, if you are a Shia journalist, you can't visit Sunni areas because you'll be treated in a suspicious way. So I suspect that Sunni in the Sunni area will talk to a Shia journalist in an open way like they are talking to a Sunni one. And if you are a Kurd, you can travel the Sunni. And the opposite way. So it's very difficult to depend on one single journalist to get the proper story. You have to, you know, look at the story from three different angles so you can make a good judgment.
You say, but you have to do it. Why do you have to do it?
You know, I feel I've got a duty. I love this country. I've been traveling to Iraq since 1978. It was my first assignment to Iraq. I remember I went there to cover the first Arab summit held in Iraq. After President Sadat of Egypt visited Jerusalem, and Arab governments decided to boycott Egypt, so they called for an Arab summit in Baghdad in 1978. Then Saddam Hussein was vice president. Since that time, I've been visiting the country.
How has it changed?
Of lot of changes. Iraq, for many who don't know Iraq, is an open-minded society. Iraq have the best brains in the Arab world, if not the world. Large number of them have been educated in American universities, in British universities, in Western universities. Iraq was leading till very recently a very moderate life. Drinks, nightclubs, easy life, women who always played a big role in the society. It's very sad to see Iraq slipping into a very, small-minded, way on different fronts. I'm sure when proper Iraqis have the right to make their views, heard and listened to, they will say, this is not the Iraq we want. Iraqis like to be governed. Iraqis till today, are willing to live with each other. Many last few months have started talking about Iraq slipping into a sectarian war or civil war. I suspect that Iraq will happen. It's true that large numbers of killings taking place in Iraq, but the way Iraqi society is made up is make it difficult. Iraq has the largest mixed marriages in the Arab and Islamic world between Sunnis and Shia. Up to 50% of Sunnis and Shia are married from each other. So I suspect that, you can do something against your brother-in-law or your son-in-law or, something related to this. I know ministers in Iraq. One of them is a very close friend of mine. She said, I've got six sisters. I am a Shiite. Five of them are married for Sunnis. How we can go into civil war against each other? This is one. If you ask the majority of Sunnis, do you mind being governed by a Shia? They will say no. Or Kerr, they will say no. Most important, how to convince each part of this society, which made Iraq, how to live together, that they should work together. That's really the most important task we are facing today. One of the biggest mistakes we have faced after the fall of the regime, that we have encouraged sectarianism. When we decided to set up the governing council, we made this governing council from...
When you say we, who do you mean?
I mean the American-led coalition at that time. They built up the governing council based on Shia-Sunni Kurds. They decided to say Shia are majority, Sunni are so minority, Kurds would be in the middle, something like this. We started this. We should have not done that. We should have looked forward to see Iraq, proceeding into a proper democracy, freedom of speech, human rights respect, all sorts of things. But the way things work wasn't what we expected. Just only recently we start, talking about sectarianism. Yes, we have encouraged it. Now we should stop it by encouraging dialogue, by making each Iraqis feel that they are part of the new Iraq, and a safe Iraq, a secure Iraq, a stable Iraq is in the interest of all Iraqis.
Can you explain the Iraqi insurgency, not the foreign fighters, but the different sectors that make it up?
Other mistakes, far from the sectarian issue, is when the army was dissolved. More than half a million Iraqi military personnel were sent home. They were not allowed to take part in the future army of their country. They were not allowed to be given jobs. This large number in the Sunni areas, in the north, they made the main bulk of the insurgency. The second decision taken and contributed to the increase in the number of insurgents are the de-ba'athification policies, where every single member of the Ba'ath Party was banned from taking a job. Why? Majority of Iraqis have joined the Ba'ath Party during Saddam Hussein because there was only way to get a job in that government, in his government. If you are a student, you know where you can get a university degree and study in university if you are not a member of the Ba'ath Party. Why we should punish the majority of Iraqis who only joined the Ba'ath Party just to earn their living? So we should have differentiate between the one who are criminals, the one who committed crimes against these people, and the one who are just innocent. They joined the Ba'ath Party like anyone, just as a procedure so they can get their degrees and study or work a job and so on. So I think if you want really to correct the situation, we should allow all Iraqi officers who have not committed anything against their country, against their people, to go back to the army and get on with their life. The same thing for the Baathists. If we've done so, I can assure you that 90% of the insurgency will just disappear. This is really one of the main issues should be addressed as soon as possible, because the more we get closer to this stage, the more we can look for Iraq stable.
And the pressure on, the U.S. pressure on al-Jafari to resign as prime minister?
Al-Jafari, one of his biggest mistakes, or to start, before we talk about Jafari, I suspect that the United States was, like, prepared to see a pro-Iranian government in power. Because the Shia-led coalition, who is in charge, is against American policies in Iraq. They are pro-Iranian, and definitely they will always keep this in mind. Whatever might affect Iranian interests in Iraq, they will be against it. And to see the American-led coalition investing heavily in rebuilding Iraq, the new Iraq, on a basis which, like, you know, to be, to stand on its feet, to find Iraq, now interior ministry is pro-Iranian, and to find another security agencies in Iraq built on pro-Iranian support. This is not what the American wants. This is not what majority of Iraqis want. That's why we start feeling the clash. I heard there are so many efforts being made to convince Jafari to step aside, but so far it failed because Jafari was elected by the Shia-led alliance as the representative for the new government. And unless the American-led coalition succeeds in convincing other parts of the component of the Shia-led alliance to change Jafari, then it's not going to work. And the way things is approached, I think it shouldn't be even-handed. We should not repeat the mistakes which have been committed in the past. You know, few months ago, just straight till the election in Iraq, we used to hear many voices in Iraq saying we want a timetable for American withdrawal from Iraq. These days, we are not hearing anything like this from the Sunnis themselves, who used to call for America. Why? Because the Sunnis, they established some kind of dialogue with the American-led coalition in Iraq. So they are on much better terms. And Sunnis today, they don't mind the Americans staying longer. That's why not a single voice been heard about this, mentioning this the last 3 months. Some kind of dialogue, it's already established. And I encourage this. It's a positive step. It should have done, been made long time ago.
And the U.S. Talking about Iran and the possibility of attacking Iran, how does that affect the situation in Iraq right
now? I think many in Iraq and the region believe this is really, you know, it's something to do with Iraq. You know, Iran practically have gained the upper hand in Iraq because all the Shia-led alliance, either the Jafari organization, Hizb al-Dawah, or al-Hakim organization, or al-Sadr, all they all well known for their Iranian sympathy and Iranian support. And I suspect that they will take any decision which might affect the Iranian position in terms of negotiation. That's why many believe that the United States is keen to try to distance these groups from Iran by a way or another, by saying, okay, let's talk about what we should do concerning Iraq, and let's separate the issue of Iraq from the nuclear dispute we have with Tehran. And I think I find it difficult because Iranians are very good at bargaining. They usually listen when they feel the United States in much stronger position to negotiate. They listen. And sometimes they are willing to go ahead in terms of implementing some kind. But the more they feel that the United States is heavily involved in the Iraqi security situation, the more said, oh, we don't bother.
We only have 30 seconds, but do you hold out any hope for Iraq?
I do have a lot of hopes for Iraq because it's so easy to solve this by addressing the problems straightforward. Starting this dialogue with Iraqi influential Sunni tribes is something helpful because it will lead to stability in the insurgents area, and then it will lead for more hope that Sunnis would be more involved in the political process. That's what we are hoping, and any success in trying to convince al-Jafari to step down and open the door for Adel Abdel Mehdi, who is like more acceptable than al-Jafari in any future government, then we can talk about political process starting in Iraq.
Zaki Shahab. Abdullayev, I want to thank you for being with us. Inside the Resistance, the Iraqi Insurgency, and the Future of the Middle East is his book, and that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shroof Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. You can go there, you can see transcripts, you can view our video video feeds, our podcasts, our audio feeds. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.